Welcome to our weekly Church on the Rock podcast. For more information, visit us at churchak.org, download our Church on the Rock AK app, or like us on our Facebook page. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy our weekly podcast.
How you doing, Palmer? You ready? I love that last verse that came up. It felt so appropriate. I, Paul, now an old man, right? My birthday is today. I turned 47-ish, something like that. Unlike Pastor Chris and Lori, I didn't get stuck at 45, you know, forever, whatever. But I will just make quick mention, because I think it'll be relevant here in just a moment, but several of my friends all ended up in Hawaii at the same time. Pastor Wampa and Rachel are there right now. Brian Cook from ACF was just there. Of course, you have to send pictures when you're in Hawaii just to harass your friends. But Jonathan and Shannon Garland just got back from there. That's why they look all tan and stuff. It's also why Jonathan looks like a 14-year-old because he shaved his beard off. But, you know, whatever. I'm not jealous or angry. I'm both. I want to give you just real quickly here five song titles, just so you can lock them away in your brain. If you're the note-taking type, which is another way of saying if you're spiritual, just kidding, that's not true. If you're the note-taking type, you can jot these down, and then we'll see if we can thread them all together over the next few moments. The first one is Just Keep Swimming. The second one is Good Lovin'. The third one is Jailhouse Rock. Fourth one is One Way or Another. And the fifth one is Dead or Alive. Sounded just like Bon Jovi, didn't it? Just Keep Swimming, Good Lovin', Jailhouse Rock, One Way or Another, and Dead or Alive. I just want to let you know, I don't know what's happening in your week this past week, but my week started off with some unexpected things. As many of you probably know already, my wife was in a head-on collision on KGB. Everyone was fine. I told her that is why I bought that car down in the ditch, is to keep my girls safe. My wife, all three of the girls were in the car, airbags deployed, the whole deal. We went to the ER, got everybody checked out, but other than bumps and bruises, they are all good. Thank you, Jesus. Yeah. But as you can imagine, for my girls especially, because last winter they were rear-ended while at a stoplight, they were traumatized by that event. And then the conversations we've been having since earlier this week with our girls range everywhere from, can we move someplace without any snow or ice, which I thought that might be the Lord, just kidding, or, this is the other one, can we just not drive anywhere for the rest of the winter, to which I said, you mean for three quarters of the year in Alaska, right? But I took them with me to CrossFit the other day, and we were on our way back. I guess this was on Friday, and we were on our way back, and these are the kinds of conversations we're having in our house right now with my girls. They're saying things like, so Dad, what do we do if we have another car accident and you die or Mom dies? I didn't know exactly what they meant about, like, what do we do with the rest of our lives, or what do we do in that moment? So I asked a few questions and discovered they were wondering, in that moment, what do we do? And so this led to a conversation on the way home that, well, first, just pray for resurrection power. If that doesn't work, then don't panic, girls. And here's the reason. Because God knows. He doesn't miss any of it, right? I mean, like if I die or mom dies, that God alone is the one that sets the times and the seasons. He alone knows when my time is up or when your time is up. And I'm fairly confident, girls, that none of that's going to happen. But even if it did, you can trust God. That's the number one thing you need to know, because you were made for more than this moment, right? You were made for eternity. And we're getting to have those conversations. Now, my girls respond to these things very differently from one another. In fact, in the ambulance, the nurse was asking my girls, how are you doing? How are you feeling? What are you thinking? And so a couple of them are sharing about they're scared and they don't want me to leave. They want me to stay there with them. But they get around to Katie, one of my girls, and they ask her how she's doing. She says, I don't want to say. I'm like, well, why don't you want to say? I just don't. Well, honey, it's okay. You can tell me, you know, what you're thinking. And she said, well, that was kind of exciting. The other two are like weeping uncontrollably. Katie's like, that was kind of exciting. When we had the earthquake happened on Olivia's birthday. Olivia, as soon as the earthquake is done, Olivia's like, that's the worst birthday ever. And Katie's beside her, I wish it was my birthday. Like they all respond totally different than one another, and yet they're all thinking through these same things. And what they really need to understand, they're going to come to understand in time, is God is sovereign. You can trust Him no matter what circumstance you find yourself in. There's the capacity to find joy even there, which is exactly what Paul is talking about in Philippians. It's often referred to as the epistle of joy because he's writing from prison, wrongfully accused and held there. And he's writing from prison to a church that has experienced heavy persecution. They've lost loved ones, and they're wondering, what does all of this mean? And will I ever see them again? And I thought this whole new kingdom of God thing was supposed to be good. And he's describing to them how God is still good in the midst of any circumstance you find yourself in. Which, of course, brings me to just keep swimming. And just keep swimming, just keep swimming. Just keep swimming. Dory the fish, right? Always forgetting where she was going. And I don't know about your family, but if you have kids, this is probably true. Or if you have a husband, this may be true of them as well, Kitri told me. But there's a distance. It can be measured in time. You really only need seconds. You don't actually need minutes for this. Or it can be measured in feet. You don't even really need yards for this, because it's a relatively short distance between the time you give a child an instruction about what they're supposed to go and do and the time in which they forget entirely what you just told them to go do. You know what I'm talking about, right? So you're like, hey, I want you to go pick up your coat that you just threw on the floor in the living room, and I want you to take it into the entryway and hang it up. And you can see it in their body language as they're walking away. Do you have the instruction? If you're smart, you do like, look me in the eye. You understand what I said? Yes, I understand what you said. And then they turn and they start to walk away, and it's almost like as they're walking really intently to do that thing, it's like, and then they start to kind of wander. And you know at that moment, they have no idea that you ever even said anything to begin with. My wife and her family has a lot of family rules that she remembers growing up. And the reason for that is because she was in a family of 11 children. And with 11 children, you got to have a lot of rules just to survive. But over the years, she's described some of them to me. For example, when I first came to visit their house, I went to the bathroom. And everything in the bathroom was attached to the wall. The hair dryer, lanyard to the wall. Hairbrush, lanyard to the wall. Right? Everything in the bathroom, everything was industrial in the bathroom. It was industrial paper towel dispensers, industrial soap and shampoo dispensers in the shower, like everything. And so they had, her dad had drawn a permanent marker line in the bottom of the bathtub that was just the right number of inches high. You had to plug the drain when you started taking your shower. When the water got to there, you were done, right? Soon he discovered there was no real way to police that without going to prison. He then just swapped out their 50-gallon hot water tank for a 25, problem solved. Water gets cold, they get out. That's what he discovered, right? They had a breakfast song that would play in the mornings. It started with, "Good morning, kids. It's time to get up and get going for school." They were homeschooled. Who cared? But anyways, time to get up and get going to school, kids. And then a song would play. And if you weren't at the table by the time the song was done, no soup for you, right? Like no breakfast that morning. So the song would play. Nobody gets out of bed till like the last chorus, right? And then it's this mad dash to the table with like one pant leg on, like, I mean, just chaos. But you had to have those kinds of rules. She told me a few years ago about this rule. In my house, we had a rule called, it was rule number 117. It was called no halfway points. In other words, when you come home from school or when you walk into the house, you don't take whatever's in your hands and set it down any place other than where it actually goes. That's a brilliant. How many of you would love if everyone in your family was already conditioned to, yeah. My wife said that's a great rule for me. But the rule was followed up by, if you set it down in a random spot, a halfway point, it can then be confiscated and taken away. Which is why I have no clothes left other than these. Kitri's taking them all to thrifters. No halfway points. And it got me thinking, like, wouldn't it be nice if when it came to maturing in life, there were no halfway points? Like, people didn't stall out somewhere, don't nudge your spouse right now. Like we just kept growing and maturing. Maybe you've heard about this term, prolonged adolescence. Right, it's a new thing that's sort of emerging because used to this season of adolescence was coming to an end around 18 or 19 years old for young people, but now they're discovering that somewhere in their 30s, the characteristics that go with adolescence and immaturity and some of those things are stretching all the way into their 30s and in some random cases into their 40s. But here's the thing, that's not how God intended it to be. And in fact, Paul's going to address this in Philippians chapter 1, starting in verse 3 through 6, as he's writing to this new and emerging church there. "I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ." That's good news. Like, the God who began this work in you is still doing this work. You need to keep your ears tuned in to hear what he's saying and how he's leading you. My problem isn't with any of that. My problem is with how long it seems to take for you to mature and me to mature, right? I mean, even currently in my life, as recent as 2 weekends ago, like, there are really big things that God's unearthing in my life that he's showing me about myself and these things, these areas where he wants to mature me. And my guess is that he's going to keep doing that for the rest of my life. I hope he keeps doing that for the rest of my life till I go home to be with him or until he comes back to us. So the question is, then what should I do right now while I'm waiting for someday as I continue to grow? And I would say, just keep swimming, just keep swimming. Don't give up. Don't stall out. Don't quit moving. Keep growing. Keep maturing, which of course brings me to Good Lovin'. It's been a real challenge, this particular song has. "I was feeling so bad. I asked my family doctor just what I had. I said, doctor..." Good, there's pagans in this service. Last service, they were either all homeschooled or they all grew up in church. Like, "I said, doctor, doctor, Mr. MD." Good, you, oh, some, it's not MD, it's doctor again. Well done. "Can you tell me what's ailing me?" And he said, "Yeah, yeah, 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 yeah." Okay, forget that part. "Yes, indeed, all you really need is good love," right? Give me that good loving. All I really need is love. How do you define good love? Like, what makes love good? And better yet, how do you even define love? Is love primarily a feeling, or is love primarily an action? It's a little bit of a trick question if you've been in church world very long, because you're probably thinking, oh, it's an action, right? Love's primarily an action. Is it primarily a feeling or an action. Maybe you've heard people say this before. Listen, you have to love everyone, but you don't have to like them. In other words, you can love people and have no affection for them, right? And yet imagine you're standing before the throne of the living God, right, on that day, and he says to you, I just want you to know that I love you, but I don't have to like you, right? Like, I mean, when we're talking about love, it's expressed from God. He sets the standard for what it actually looks like. And maybe you've heard of the love chapter before, but often when I hear young people describe, and adults now I'm discovering, describe being in love, what they're really describing is feeling an emotion, experiencing a biological attraction. But emotion and biological attraction don't equal love from a biblical standpoint. In fact, when I'm preaching to youth groups and that sort of thing, or often in counseling situations, I'll inform people that what you're referring to as love cannot possibly be love from a biblical description. Because young ladies, I just want you to know this, anytime that guy puts you in a position in which you are at odds with your heavenly Father, he isn't loving you. I don't care if he used his parents' money to buy you roses or not. Right? Like he's not being loving if he's leading you into conflict with your Father in heaven. I don't care how you feel. The action is not in keeping with what the Scriptures call love. Paul's going to address this in Philippians 1, verses 9 through 11. He says, it is my prayer that your love may abound more and more. In other words, love has the capacity to expand and grow. It may abound more and more, listen, with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent, and thus, or so, be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. If you were to put this in a formula, it would look something like this. Love, right, these feelings of affection, endearment, love plus knowledge and discernment equal the ability to affirm what is good or excellent. Often we say that love is blind, right, that I just fell into it. And yet the reality is you and I are called to exercise knowledge and discernment. When those things are coupled together, we get to experience what is excellent or good, right? 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, maybe you've heard it before. I love this description. If I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body, I could boast about it. But if I did not love others, I would have gained nothing. Here's what's interesting to me. If I performed actions that are in keeping with love, right? If I laid my life down for someone else, if I sold everything I had and gave it away to the poor, those actions are in keeping with what we would typically say love does. And yet the reality is I could not be loving and do those things, and I've gained nothing by it. He goes on, love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous of the garlands when they go to Hawaii, or it's not in there, but it should be, or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It is not irritable or hangry, and it keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. That's a pretty high bar, right? And yet his prayer is that our love would abound. It would grow in its capacity to be expressed in this way. Knowing what is excellent or good plus obedience or action leads to abounding love. I say it this way. The degree to which we act on our emotions in a righteous manner is the degree to which we are actually loving someone. Which, of course, brings me to Jailhouse Rock. A little known fact, but my uncle, Jeff, was an Elvis impersonator in Memphis. It was pretty good, actually. I mean, he had the same guy who made Elvis's belts for him, made his belts for him. Like, he would do these shows. I can remember when I was a little kid, he'd do these shows in Memphis, and like, all of these people, mostly old ladies, would show up, and they would give him like fake jewelry after the shows. Well, one time he let me get on stage with him. My grandmother made me my own little Elvis jumpsuit. There are no pictures of this, which I'm super grateful for. My own little Elvis jumpsuit. I just had to learn one thing. It was this, right? And he would do all the Elvis repertoire. And the Elvis repertoire, there's one song that's just sort of weird. And if you've ever seen the video that goes with it, it's Jailhouse Rock, right? And the warden threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there and they began to wail. The band was jumping and they began to swing. You should have heard them knocked out jailbirds sing, let's rock. Everybody, let's rock. Oh, such a good song. It's ridiculous. Like, seriously, who's excited to be in prison besides Elvis and Paul? Like, listen to what Paul has to say about his incarceration. Philippians 1, verse 12. I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Hey, listen, I just want you to understand, don't worry about what's happened to me. Like, God's up to something. Because I'm imprisoned in Rome, the entire imperial guard has gotten to hear the message of the gospel. They know exactly why I'm here. And the brothers, the saints who are here in Rome, they are emboldened by my willingness to be in chains for Christ. You ever met those people who just seem excited about Jesus no matter what? They're the Bill Pagarans of the world. Like, if you don't know this about Bill, count yourself lucky that you're already at church and hopefully already in relationship with the Lord, because he'd be hunting you down otherwise. He can't help but share his faith everywhere he goes, and it's so contagious. In fact, I wish he'd quit doing it, because I feel really bad about myself as a result, right? But what happens in those sorts of people as they live out how God's designed them is you find yourself encouraged, emboldened to share the good news. And that's what Paul is saying. Is he's saying, in my circumstances, my ability to find joy even here is encouraging the rest of the church to be faithful with sharing the good news. Listen, there's a long history of lovers of God being wrongfully accused and imprisoned for their faith. Not just in post-biblical times, but even during biblical times. And the one that comes to mind for me immediately is a young man named Joseph. Maybe you've heard his story before, Joseph in the coat of many colors. It's this youngest son of a man named Jacob, and Joseph is having these dreams and visions, and his father has made him this beautiful coat, and his brothers are just getting more and more jealous over time, and so they concoct a plan to kill him and then tell his father that he's been killed by wild animals. But their older brother says, no, let's not do that. Let's put him in a pit until we decide what to do with him. But as he goes away, the other brothers sell him to a caravan that comes, and he ends up as a slave in Egypt at 17 years old. And there he is in Egypt in the house of a man named Potiphar, and he's living there. He'll be in Potiphar's house for about 11 years until Potiphar's wife wrongfully accuses him, and then he's taken into prison and thrown into a dungeon. And so he goes from being a slave to being a prisoner in one of the deepest, darkest dungeons. He'll spend more than 2 years there. And then Pharaoh hears about him, and he ends up stepping into Pharaoh's house and becomes the second in command in all the land of Egypt. Here's the extraordinary thing about Joseph, is he didn't celebrate when he got to Pharaoh's house. He knew clearly that God was up to something even in the slavery, even in prison, and now in the house of Pharaoh. In fact, when Joseph's brothers show up on the scene because a famine has hit the land and they need to go to Egypt in order to get some food, they have no idea that the person they're speaking with is the brother they sold. Listen to this moment when they discover who he is. Genesis 45, verses 4 through 8. So Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near to him, and he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And they all wet themselves at this point. Like, that can't be good, right? Whom you sold into Egypt. Now listen to this. And now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Verse 7, and God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on the earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord over all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Listen, I know you thought you were setting me up, but it was actually God who was setting all of us up for our own good. It sounds too good to be true. Like, is that how you would respond when the moment came that the power was in your hands to return the favor? They actually don't believe he really feels this way. And so 17 years later, when dad dies, Jacob, they are now terrified all over again. He's just been waiting for dad to die so that he still looked good to dad, but he still wants to take out his vengeance on us. And so they come to him to say, we're your servants, Genesis 50, verse 18. His brothers came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, don't get me wrong, I know what you did. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. He's not a Pollyanna. He's not clueless. He recognizes, you intended evil against me. I'm just telling you, God's bigger than you and me. That he was orchestrating something in this series of events that were hellish for Joseph. And yet he fully recognizes that the sovereign God of all the universe was up to something even in those moments. What would it be like to view the world through that lens? Which brings me to one way or another. I'm going to get you one way. I want to give you two startling revelations. The first one is rather humbling. I've shared it before because it has been rather humbling to me. It's this. I don't get to decide if God will be glorified through my life. I only get to decide how. The reality is, and the scriptures bear this out in numerous places, that at the end of all things, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And so rage against him for all of your life, pretend he doesn't exist for all of your life, but the reality is, you and I don't get to decide if he will be glorified with our lives, we only get to decide how. And here's the reason. Either he will be glorified through my life by my willingness to submit to him and thus him pouring out his mercy and his grace and his compassion on me, and that is glorious and powerful, or my resistance to him my entire life and I get to reveal his glory through him pouring out his righteous judgment on me. But I don't get to decide if, I only get to decide how. That's a humbling thought. The second is this, though, and Paul's going to reveal it as well here. God doesn't only use well-intentioned people. He even uses intentionally selfish people to accomplish his purposes. I hate this one. You know why? Because when I know that someone's motivations are selfish gain, when I know their motivations are to get an empire, build a kingdom for themselves, all I want to do is expose them. That was probably the Lord telling me time's almost up. Like everything in me just wants to reveal their secret and hidden motives because I'm certain that I know them. It's why I every now and then fall into this black hole of watching televangelists just like, no, you can't sell Xeroxed copies of your hand for healing. Like, that's not okay, right? All that weird stuff. Listen to what Paul has to say, Philippians 1, verse 15. It's true that some are preaching out of jealousy and rivalry. That's not good, just in case you were wondering. But others preach about Christ with pure motives. They preach because they love me, for they know I have been appointed to defend the good news. Those others do not have pure motives as they preach about Christ. They preach with selfish ambition, not sincerely, intending to make my chains more painful to me. But that doesn't matter. Whether their motives are false or genuine, the message about Christ is being preached. Either way, so I rejoice. Really? I mean, here's what Paul fundamentally knows. There's a time that I need to confront bad behavior, but I am not going to waste all my time trying to discern everyone else's motives. And truthfully, God is always using imperfect people to preach the perfect message of the gospel. It's just degrees of imperfection, right? And there are imperfections that disqualify us from certain roles, but the reality is he's always using imperfect people to preach the perfect message of the gospel. What Paul's really saying is, in this particular case, it's painful for me. They're trying to inflict pain on me through the preaching of the gospel, but I don't care. My life isn't my own. The gospel's being preached, and for that, I rejoice. Which brings me to wanted dead or alive. Pastor Chris, they didn't know like hardly any of these songs. Like, dude, I thought you were a pagan back in the day. Three, okay, that's not bad. Wanted dead or alive. Philippians 1, verse 18 through 21. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. I just want to pause there for one second, because until you read the rest, you could assume that what he's saying is, oh, I know I'm going to be cleared of all charges. I'm going to be out and free again. I know this is going to turn out good for me. But he says, as it is, my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. Verse 21, for me to live is Christ. For me to die is gain. I love how the NLT says this. For to me, living, in this case, in prison, for to me, living means living for Christ, and dying is even better. Crazy way to think about life. If I were to pick a theme for this section of Paul's letter, in fact, if I were to pick a theme for Paul's life, it would be this: living with an eternal perspective. What Paul fundamentally understands is that you and I were created for so much more than these brief moments on this big ball of dirt, that this life is going to come to an end, and that moment, whenever it is, will feel brief. You were made for more than that. What you were made for is eternity with God. And he fundamentally recognizes that if I live a little bit longer here, sweet, that's to the benefit of all of you, and it's for the glory of Christ. And if I am to die, sweeter, like I get to be with God. It changes the way you and I live our lives. We begin to live with open hearts and an open hand in almost every area. What would it look like to live our life in this way? Gospel-centered, Christ-like living. Often people like to think about it in sort of the big picture. Well, if I'm ever thrown in prison for Jesus, I will stand for Jesus. If the day ever comes where I'm asked to take the mark of the beast, I will not do it. If the day comes that I have to lay my life down for the gospel, I will. But here's the reality. If you and I aren't doing it now, we probably aren't going to do it then. And the way it happens now is so subtle and so consistent. It's in my marriage. It's with my kids. It's in every... I'll just give you a really practical example. I now realize that I made a critical error in judgment recently. I'm sure it's one of many, but we bought new couches because my wife hated our old couches because they weren't comfortable. And so we bought reclining couches, which we call old people couches, because we're there, apparently. You push that little button. You don't even have to pull a lever. You push a little button on the side. It's like, boom. It puts your feet up. you lay back, so the little button like pushes your head up if you want. Like, I don't even have to nod to answer questions anymore. It's a slow yes, but I'm saying yes to you, Kitri. Here's the only major problem with the couches. I've discovered that there is no sound barrier that they create between the kitchen and the couches in the living room. It's these stupid open floor plans we have now. So I hear Kitri in the kitchen anytime she's like washing dishes or rattling pots and pans around or cooking, and it's super irritating because I'm trying to relax, you know. And so I was praying about it the other day. I was like, Lord, can you teach her to stop making me feel so guilty for enjoying the gift of this couch you've given us? And I heard this still small voice come back and say, you idiot, that's not her making you feel guilty, it's my spirit. Satan? Anyways, you can't imagine when you feel that conviction from the Lord, how far away those buttons get on the side of the couch. It's like my arm just can't reach them. It's, oh, I'll try and put the couch back up to that really uncomfortable upright position. And because I know what the Lord's asking me to do, right? He's asking me to get off my butt and go into the, I don't know if you say that here, just one T, and go into the kitchen and like love my wife, like serve, right? It's so simple and so practical, and I miss it so often, but there are those moments the Lord rings my bell and he's like, hey, this is what it looks like to lay your life down. This is what love does. And so I get off the couch and I go and help. It's 1,000 different ways in our everyday life that we begin to live out the kind of life Paul is calling this church to, so that if the moment presents itself, and it very well may, when I have to lose something significant to say yes to the good news of the gospel, I've already been conditioned to walk in step with the Spirit in those moments. And so Paul is saying, don't give up, just keep swimming. Learn how to love well by my definition. Trust me, no matter the circumstances, whether it's incarceration or whether it's getting off the couch, and hold your life with an open heart and an open hand, that you would serve me either in life or in death, but either way is a win. Recently, it's really been about a 7-month process that God's been sort of unveiling some things that I didn't even know were there in my heart. And they're actually things that I thought I had dealt with a long time ago. And as I've been dealing with them now, what I've realized is that God's intentions in purifying us, his intentions in changing the way we think, his intentions are really not that we learn how to manage our brokenness, but that we would be healed of our brokenness. And I've experienced that even 2 weekends ago, just God doing some radical things in my own heart. I didn't even realize we're there in that moment. But I had this fundamental question that had been developed over years and years of experience and belief. And the question was this: God, where are you? Like, I wouldn't say I've ever felt like distant from God, but I had this fundamental belief that when the time comes and I can't run any further, I can't run any harder, and I finally hit the wall, that he's not going to show up. I'm not going to go into why I felt that way. I didn't even really know it was there until in this moment in prayers. I've been wrestling through these things. And the Lord took me to a passage in Isaiah. I didn't even know where the passage was, and I only knew a piece of it. But it was in Isaiah 65. In Isaiah 65, this is what he says: I called a people who were not my people to myself. I made a people who did not exist. And he says this: and I cried out, here I am. Here I am. I stand all day long like a father with outstretched hands over a people who have turned from me. I don't know what it is today for you. I do know this: the same God who began a good work in you is still doing that work. He'll keep doing it until the day you go home to be with him or he comes to get us. That there are things in this moment that you're probably already thinking about that he is calling you to, that are on that journey of abounding love and maturing faith. Jesus, we ask that your Holy Spirit would do the thing that only your Spirit can do. our willingness to submit, you would bring about transformation that we could never accomplish on our own. Jesus, would you drive deep roots in our hearts right now that would produce good fruit in the days ahead? In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening. For more of our podcasts and to discover how you can connect, visit us at churchak.org or download our Church on the Rock AK app from either iTunes or Google Play.